From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. Many states are facing painful austerity cuts. So one thing we want to discuss on today's program is the state of states and ask how Iowa's fiscal problems compare to those in other states and what issues will come up in the next legislative session. Also, the House GOP in Washington has unveiled its answer to President Obama's health insurance reform. We'll talk about that. These and other issues with our guest this week, political scientist Bruce Nesmith of Coe College and New Hampshire political analyst Arne Arneson. Our discussion starts right after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us over the noon hour for this Politics Wednesday, a chance to analyze and think out loud about recent political developments in the nation and, of course, right here in Iowa. Today, a few of the items we want to touch on. As many states face painful austerity cuts, we want to ask how Iowa's fiscal problems compare to those in other states and the political repercussions of that, and what issues will come up in the next legislative session in Des Moines, which begins next week. And of course, in Washington, on this, the first day of the new Congress, we want to talk about how the House GOP has unveiled its answer to President Obama's health insurance reform. A few of the things we'll want to look at this week with our guests, Bruce Nesmith, Chair of Political Science at Coe College in Cedar Rapids. Welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon. And also joining us by phone, New Hampshire political analyst Arne Arneson. Arne, are you there?
I am here, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Let's start off with this state of the states. We're certainly aware of the federal deficit problem, but another financial crisis is looming that involves state and local governments, much less press coverage here. And each state finds itself in a different situation. Up to now, this economic crisis, states have been getting by having billions of dollars in federal stimulus money, but that money is running out, and we are told a day of reckoning is at hand. Here's Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey talking recently on 60 Minutes with Steve Croft about canceling a subway project between New Jersey and Manhattan, I believe, a project that involved lots of federal money and would have created for New Jersey 6,000 jobs.
I cancel it. The bottom line is I don't have the money. And you know what? I can't pay people for those jobs if I don't have the money to pay them. Where am I getting the money? I don't have it. I literally don't have it.
Is this going on all over the country?
Yes. Of course it is. It's not like you can avoid it forever because it's here now. We all know it's here. And the federal government doesn't have the money to paper over it anymore either for the states. The day of reckoning has arrived. That's it. And it's going to arrive everywhere. And time may vary a little bit depending upon which state you're in, but it's coming.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie talking on CBS's 60 Minutes. So let's talk about the state of the states. Why not begin with our own state, Bruce Nesmith, the outlook for Iowa's budget in the coming year and the political implications. What's a summary of that?
Well, Ben, I think first of all we need to realize that the states are in a different position than the federal government. A lot of the federal budget problem, as you referred to it, has been voluntarily taken on. They didn't need to do stimulus. Well, you know, arguably they need to do something, but that was a voluntary policy that the government took on. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which are very expensive, were voluntarily taken on. The federal government is allowed to borrow money at whatever to whatever amount that the government's willing to authorize. States are not. States are required, all but one, required by their constitutions to run a balanced budget, which means that they run into revenue limitations a lot sooner than the national government does. They can't run a deficit. They can move things around and play some accounting games to keep things afloat for a while. But as Governor Christie pointed out, they're not in a position where they can do large amounts of borrowing. So they've been surviving pretty much on federal stimulus money for the last couple of years. Iowa is in not an ideal position, but maybe not as bad as other states are that may have greater problems with poverty or a declining industrial base. Iowa has a much lower unemployment than the nation as a whole. But still, running into expenses that are going to exceed revenues, running into situations where projects are going to cost money, as Governor Christie suggested, projects that might cost money would have to be played off against other obligations and expenditures.
Mm-hmm. And we have been hearing this week about the Taxpayers First Act, a GOP proposal released this week. Many implications there, drastic cutbacks in spending by the state. For instance, Iowa's voluntary preschool program eliminated. State employees would have to pay health care premiums. Family planning services scaled back. Axing money for business incentive programs, axing money for new passenger train service between Iowa City and Chicago. A few of the things under this GOP proposal. We want to reach out to our listeners in the first part of this program to ask, how do we keep our fiscal house in order here in Iowa in these lean economic times? Whose taxes should be raised, if taxes should be raised? What services should be cut? What do you think of the proposed plan by Iowa GOP lawmakers to make drastic cuts in services? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. In New Hampshire, Arnie Arneson is with us. Give us a picture of what's going on there to contrast with Iowa.
I want to start by going to sort of at the beginning of the conversation. We were talking about how states are so different from the federal government because they can't borrow, and you're absolutely right. That's the difference with all the states, except for the little tiny state of Vermont, Bruce. I just want to let you know it's always been somewhat quirky.
I knew there was one.
It is. It's the only one that doesn't fit into that picture. But what does fit into the picture is if you go to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, you'll see that 46 states out of the 50 are facing shortfalls. So Iowa, you ain't alone. New Hampshire, you're not alone. And I'm actually looking at their website, and they're talking about the shortfall as a percent of the fiscal year 2011 budget for this year. In Iowa, your shortfall is about 20% of the budget. Our shortfall in the state of New Hampshire is about 27% of the budget. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds astronomical until you start looking at some of the other states. You can feel a little bit better, you know, like Arizona, 36%, or you can look at, you know, Maine at 35%, or this is the real kicker, Nevada, 54%.
Right.
Oh, my God, where did they go? Now, what you need to understand, though, is that the states have been benefiting from a significant amount of investment from the federal government. And if it's bad in 2011, it will be worse in 2012, Bruce, because those federal dollars are drying up. And most of these states are now going to have to be on their own. And that is really where part of this frightening story comes from. But there's a little history to why states are in some ways facing a real difficulty. Over the last probably 20 or 30 years, if not even before that, states' tax policy has become more and more regressive. So if there was a progressive component in it, they tend to back away. They love to fee you to death. They love to do property taxes that don't care whether you have an income or not. They like to do things that sound reasonable on its face, but when it comes to progressivity, it means that the wealthy, for the most part, haven't really taken a hit. So that's part of the problem is you don't have the federal dollars. You have a less progressive tax structure. In Iowa, you have really a fairly booming agricultural community. In the state of New Hampshire, somewhat like Iowa, we have very low unemployment. We're doing fairly well. It turns out New Hampshire has the highest median income in the United States. And one of the reasons why we're facing such shortfalls in our budget is because we have no income tax or no sales tax. So even if people are doing swimmingly well, you'd have no idea because there's no way to tap any of that wealth.
I'm wondering.
We basically go under.
I want to ask both you, Arnie, and Bruce here about the mood, the political mood of the people as you see it when we listen to the harsh words. Maybe you could call it tough love, delivered by Chris Christie, saying, you know, wake up. We've got to realize that this is the day of reckoning. Do you think that message is getting through to people out in New Hampshire, out on the East Coast? Bruce, do you think it's getting out to people in Iowa? Is that sinking in? Do we have the feeling that our backs are to the wall now, Bruce?
I'm not getting that sense. I think where a lot of people have perhaps exaggerated ideas about how much waste government does.
Exactly.
And so the perception is that that savings can come from reducing waste and from reducing benefits to groups that may not deserve those benefits. I noticed, for example, one of the items in the Taxpayer Relief Act in Iowa is to eliminate sabbaticals for university faculty, state university faculty. The savings, the amount of total savings there is like $165,000 or something that will be maybe a third of a drop in the bucket. But it targets an unpopular group, or at least a group that I would say, you know, most people don't understand why university professors have sabbaticals and why nobody else does and things like that. So that's a fairly easy target. So I think that the perception is that through waste and through eliminating benefits to undeserving groups, we can get most of the shortfall fixed.
You know, since I'm not the faculty person here, I can cover you, Bruce. And the reason I'm going to do that is, let me tell people a little bit about what some of those professors do on sabbaticals. If you look at most of your state universities and most of your universities around the country, a lot of the largest grants coming into your state come because professors work on those grants. Those are grants that come to the university. Those are grants that create jobs. Those are grants that, I mean, it's unbelievable to me how people don't, you know the rest of the story. And they look at these things in isolation. They see the savings, but they don't look at the consequences of the savings. And I think the part that the Republicans have played for a number of years in Washington is that they've had an opportunity to do a lot of great political theater. They've demonized everything. They've, you know, referred to death panels. They've, you know, they want to repeal Obamacare because they call it the job killer. Well, now they're in a position in Iowa because they now control the House, in New Hampshire because they control everything, and now in Washington to actually have to govern. And so the interesting thing is that actions have consequences. And when you start looking at what that fat is, it turns out that fat is going to impact real people in places like Iowa, real people in places like New Hampshire, that is going to have consequences that far outweigh the savings. And that's where the rubber hits the road. And I looked at your items on the budget in Iowa, and, you know, it's people are looking at the dollars. They're not looking at what are going to be the consequences once those programs disappear, and can you afford those consequences?
Arnie Arneson with us, along with Bruce Nesmith, 1-866-780-9100, talking about austere times in state budgets for this first half hour, 1-866-780-9100. How do we keep our fiscal house in order in these lean economic times? Don is joining us from Iowa City. Good afternoon, John. Don.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Don. Go ahead.
Oh, well, you're talking about politicians are talking about austere times, you know, for things like road infrastructure and education. How in the name of Sam Hill can we allow these miscreants to keep funding the Afghan and Iraq wars for, what, $1 million a week, $1 billion a month? I don't know. I mean, most of these guys haven't even got the testosterone to go fight a war themselves. They send our youth off to war based on a lie. Mm-hmm. And
well, the argument there, Don, is that it's in our national interest to be in Afghanistan to finish up the war in Iraq.
How has our national interest been furthered?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just point out that if U.S. involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan ended today, it would not help the fiscal position of the states. The national government does not seem to be in any mood to stimulate the economy through grants to state governments, which they've been doing for most of the last 2 years. So if the wars ended, it would probably result in budgetary savings at the national level, but would not be felt at the state level.
Okay. Don, thank you very much for that call from Iowa City. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. When we look at cuts at a state level versus a federal level, what are your thoughts, Bruce and Arnie, about how they play out differently politically when we are looking at drastic cuts at a state level compared to a federal level? It seems at first glance that at a state level they are more directly affecting us. Is that right, Bruce?
I think it probably does. I mean, in the extent of, for example, road maintenance or things like that. We've been fortunate in Iowa so far to escape massive weather. I don't know, Arnie, if New Hampshire was hit by the blizzard that turned New York City upside down. But the ability to respond to natural emergencies like that, the ability to keep up on stuff like roads and bridges, I think that you don't necessarily see that impact right away. If we cut the budget, for example, for roads, I don't think, you know, there wouldn't immediately be huge potholes.
Can I mention something, Bruce? Let me just say something,
sure.
Because I'm so glad you brought this up about, you know, what happened with the snowstorm. It didn't impact New Hampshire, but a friend of mine just came home from New Jersey. And there was a picture, I think it was in the Star Ledger, and the picture of the Star Ledger was like, you know, 4 feet of snow on the roads. You wouldn't have believed it. It looked like, you looked like you were in the North Pole. But you know what that picture was? That was day 4 after the snowstorm. Not day 1. Not day 2. That was on the road. 4 feet of snow 4 days after the snowstorm in New Jersey. You know, in a major community in New Jersey. And basically what they said is, this is our future. And I just want everyone to begin to think is, you know, when we were talking about the economic meltdown and the financial meltdown on Wall Street, we suddenly managed to write huge checks because, God forbid, something would happen. And some of that money has been paid back. But isn't it fascinating when we start doing triage as a nation, what we turn to and run to first, and then you look at that 4 feet of snow 4 days after the snowstorm, and you keep thinking, what are the consequences of that failure? And I don't know who is the lobbyist for those kinds of failures, and I don't know who tells the story, and I don't know which Tea Party activist cares about that, but there are significant consequences across the country, and that's why when you cut those state budgets and you cut those state workers and you make those kinds of results, they are going to have dramatic impacts on the economy in our state and on our future. And it's going to be very difficult to figure out how to reprioritize, but at the same time, we're also going to have to figure out what do we choose to invest in and how do we raise that money. And at some point, we're all going to have to sacrifice something. And I'm not sure who's sacrificing right now. I know a lot of people on unemployment are, but that's because they can't find work because there are 6 people for every job opening. You know, it's getting tough.
1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Elise in Iowa City. Elise, are you there?
I am.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi. I wanted to make a couple of points. The first one is that since 1980, the population of the United States has grown by at least one-third. The size of federal government has only grown by 3%. All of the rhetoric about government being too large is disingenuous, and it's disingenuous populism that's meant just for power mongering. I can't imagine otherwise why that huge lie would be being spun. The second thing that I'd like to mention is that the Tea Party keeps being referred to as a grassroots movement, but it is really not. It was originally funded by the Koch brothers, super billionaires, multi-billionaires, who wanted to gut regulation of their industries, which are highly polluting industries. They wanted to gut taxation to keep their billions safe, and they wanted to make sure that they're not paying their fair share for the infrastructure that allows them to run these huge corporations. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Elise, thank you for that call. Do we have a reaction before we move on, Arnie or Bruce, perhaps? We'll just move on to John. Looking at the time here, we have to take a break in a minute. John is joining us from Des Moines. Hi, John.
Hey, thanks for the call. First, a quick comment. You know, one of your guests had said that the wars don't really affect the state budgets. I think that needs to be looked at a little deeper because with such a high percentage of National Guardsmen, I think that it's not a fair statement to say it doesn't impact, you know, state coffers because of the loss of revenues from some of the jobs and on and on. But that's not what I called about. My concern, and it's been a big point for me for a long time, is this disparity in drug costs globally. When you look at what the U.S. pays for drugs compared to Canada and Europe especially, it's just huge. And the problem is, you know, we know how big Medicare, Medicaid is in the federal budget as well as in the state budgets. And we've got legislators right here in Iowa, I'm not going to name them, but the truth is they have voted many, many times to prevent the states from acquiring drugs as economically as possible, like from Canada, for fear of losing federal dollars. And we don't think about the implications of how these high costs have actually been a determining factor for a lot of employers to outsource jobs. So rather than fight this drug industry, you know, which, again, it's largely European. You have to look at where Bayer and Pfizer and SmithGlaxoKline and on, where they're really from and where their profits go. So I think that's a discussion that we've been avoiding, but we need to have because it has such a big impact on both federal and state budgets.
Okay, John, you're dovetailing right into a topic we wanted to explore further in our second half hour. We can begin it now. Health insurance reform and the GOP's promise to try to repeal that. A reaction to John there.
First of all, I think he makes an excellent point that health insurance costs are a huge burden on any employer that provides them, and that includes state governments.
And his point about drugs is also important, because let's remember that we've been told that capitalism is such an important tool. And capitalism means you do cost comparisons, and you want to get the cheapest drug for the best value. Everyone can do that except for government. So that's the mind-blowing thing. Government that's spending 60% of all the healthcare dollars in this country is prohibited from acting in a capitalist fashion when it's acquiring its billions and trillions of dollars worth of drugs and healthcare products. And that makes no sense, because that ultimately is driving costs up. It's meaning that we are spending more and getting less, and getting less healthy. That's the part, Ben, that's so remarkable. Everyone talks about the best healthcare system in the world. Then explain to me why we rank 17th in the world when it comes to a number of the mortality issues. So, you know, we're spending a lot, but if the consequences, I go back to actions have consequences, if the consequences are we are a less healthy nation, then you have to ask, where's my money going?
Okay, we have a couple minutes, just over 60 seconds. Mike in Waterloo, a quick comment before we have to take a break.
I got a couple of questions, a couple of comments. One is I hear Arnie saying, you know, that we magically came up with the money for New Jersey. If what we're hearing is correct, us as the American public, we didn't magically come up with the money. We borrowed the money and wrote the check, and then we passed the debt on to our kids, grandkids, etc. If that's correct, what we're being told in the media.
Quickly, Mike, your other point?
That at some point we're going to have to bite the bullet, and biting the bullet doesn't mean a quick sacrifice. It means that we may have to go without work. We might have to go without quick snow removal. We might have to go without some of those luxuries that we take for granted to get us back in financial stability.
Okay, Mike, thank you for your call from Waterloo. We're going to take a short break now and be back talking more about keeping our fiscal house in order. Are you willing to sacrifice? We're talking about who should pay, what services should get cut. Also, when we come back, we want to talk about how House Republicans have made public the text of their bill to repeal President Obama's health insurance reforms. Your thoughts on that when we come back. What do you think should be the top priorities for our lawmakers here in Iowa, in Des Moines, when the new session gets underway next week? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. It's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange with Bruce Nesmith and Arnie Arneson, back in just a few minutes. And it's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio. Great to have you with us over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our guests are political analysts this week. Bruce Nesmith, chair of political science at Coe College in Cedar Rapids. New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson joining us by phone from New Hampshire. And you're welcome to join our discussion as we analyze and think out loud about recent political developments in the nation and here in Iowa. And we're talking about the austere budgetary times in our first half hour. Continuing to talk about that as well, we want to include a few other things and your calls as well, 1-866-780-9100. Are you willing to sacrifice? What do you think about the possibility of repealing President Obama's health insurance reform, the long battle that led up in the passage of that last year? 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Before we do go to the callers and talk a little bit more about health care, I wanted to have you, Bruce, and you, Arnie, talk a little bit about what's happening in the respective legislative sessions in a state level. What can we expect in this session to begin in Iowa next week? A quick survey.
Well, Ben, we talked about the Taxpayer Relief Act. It has a number of components, and each of them has, besides the financial element, they have policy components. For example, union protections for state government workers and things like that. Beyond that, we might see state consideration of gay marriage. Governor Branstad seems to have tamped down talk of impeaching judges, but there may be some other ways of trying to address that decision. That's probably the one non-financial related decision that I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Arnie Arneson, also some developments in New Hampshire to do with same-sex marriage, aren't there?
Well, there are, but that's in part because unlike Iowa, New Hampshire was the only state in the nation which legislatively, not through a court, not through a mandate, but through the legislature, actually embraced the concept of gay marriage. So I guess if they're going to be trying to impeach the Supreme Court in Iowa, they're going to have a lot of impeaching to do in New Hampshire because it was the legislature that decided that. But there's been a movement afoot, and it's not just homegrown movement about repealing gay marriage. I was looking at a website from Illinois, and it was a conservative fundamentalist group, and the number one thing on their list of things to do was to repeal the gay marriage law in New Hampshire. And that was on an Illinois site. So I just want everyone to understand that sometimes it's not necessarily locally grown, some of these fights. Some of these fights are basically being fertilized by groups around the country. But the other thing is, it's so interesting, because we know that it's jobs, 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 the economy, the economy, the economy. So what was the first thing the new New Hampshire legislature did? They brought guns back into the state house.
I'm so excited.
We need weapons, not words.
I saw a little write-up about this. So up until this point, the State House in New Hampshire, it was you were not allowed to pack heat, and you will be able to now.
Well, actually, you could always pack heat because they opened their mouths and the heat just kept coming out. But now you get to carry the heat and pack the heat, you know?
What prompted this? Why did the lawmakers feel they had reason to defend themselves with a weapon?
Well, actually, what was fascinating was one of the law we had I think the law in the books from 1998, and it had then been repealed for 2 years, and then was reinstated by the Democratic legislature. And that's in part because people were looking up in the balcony, and people were like, you know, holding their weapons up during some discussion of a bill,
and people were going,
"Whoa, that's not a pencil," you know.
Right.
And but I just think it's ironic that was the first move afoot. You know, when you ask, I would say 99% of people in my state, you know, what do they care about? I don't think weapons in the state House was the first, second, or 25th thing on their list, but it was the first thing that the New Hampshire legislature embraced. The other thing that we're going to be seeing across the board in all 50 states, and if you actually looked at the New York Times, I believe it was yesterday, there is going to be a assault on unions, and in particular public unions, because basically we don't really have any private sector unions left in America because we don't have any manufacturing left in America. But what we did see was the rise of public sector unions probably in the late 70s and early 80s. And public sector unions have a direct relationship to everyone in your state. They provide the services. They get paid by your tax revenues. And so if you're going to find something evil, then it will probably be a public sector worker, unless, of course, the fire is in your house and you need that firefighter who happens to be unionized. Or, you know, the cop shows up because there was a robbery at your house and you're going to need that cop who happened to be unionized. But a number of states are focusing on the public sector unions and what they can do from either their retirement packages or how they can negotiate their contracts. And that's another bill that we're looking at in New Hampshire. That's another one of the first out of the box is about undermining some of the contracts.
Arnie Arneson with us, along with Bruce Nesmith. And let's go back to our phones. Edith is joining us from Windsor Heights. What's on your mind politically, Edith?
Well, in the discussion of where states can cut spending a little earlier in the hour, There was talk of, well, you can cut on roads, though the results will show up down the track, except that we've been cutting back on our infrastructure for years already, so we've already got a big backlog. And just looking at bridges, I mean, people are in danger because we haven't kept up, and now we're going to do less? I mean, that really alarms me.
Mm-hmm. So, Edith, where would you choose to sacrifice? What, if we have to cut services, what services would you say?
Well, I'm going to be a little contrary on this one because we've been talking cuts, cuts, cuts. And when you're trying to balance a budget, whether it's at home or in the government, you have to look at both cuts and the income. And I think we've gone to some extremes on cutting on tax receipts. I think there are people who, if they're as much of supporters of the U.S. as they claim to be, they ought to be glad to pay a little more taxes. And I think that's got to be a key part of balancing the budgets. And I think that was shown at the federal level in the Simpson Committee report this fall. We can't do it just with cuts.
Okay. Edith, thank you for your thoughts from Windsor Heights. Bruce, you wanted to chime in there.
Yeah, I think that that there's greater difficulty beyond the political difficulty and the perhaps toxic nature of tax increase legislation. There's a particular difficulty in doing that at the state level, and it goes back to some of the stuff we talked about earlier. But the concern is that it's easier to move a company or some other source of tax revenue from state to state than it is from country to country.
Okay, let's move on to the topic of health insurance that was raised earlier in the hour. Let's go back to this because House Republicans in Washington are saying they're going to make good on their attempt to repeal President Obama's health insurance reforms. What is actually the plan there, Arnie, that the Republicans have? How likely their success?
It's pithy. I think it's 2 pages.
Yeah, very, very short. Not 2,000 pages?
It's 2 pages long. I think it says, go back to everything that happened before anything was passed under the health care plan embraced by the Democrats and Obama. I think it just wants to go to like the day before, and that's where they want to start. That may pass in the House. It's clearly not going to pass in the Senate. But I want to remind people, you know, some of the things that they're talking about repealing are things like pre-existing conditions, you know, when you can't get access to health insurance, the idea that you can include your young adult children up to the age of 26 on your health care plan, which I know a lot of people are seeing their children leaving college, not finding work. And I remember about the unemployment rate here, you know, when they don't have a work experience or they don't have a resume. And the last thing you want is to have a gap of insurance between when they're in school and when they find their first job. And a lot of those things are things that the public approves of by 80 and 85%. So it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. But the sad thing is I do think that we have to address health care issues, and I do think that there are cost issues, and they're right about some of the job-killing things about health care. But here's one of the job-killing things about health care. We spend more money on specialists in this country that are the most expensive, and we have less access to primary care docs that are cheaper than your specialists that could actually make you healthier. So we just spend money badly. We don't make you healthy. We waste cash, and I wish the Republicans would look at the waste issue because I think they're right about money, but they're wrong with their target.
Okay. Tom writes in an email, someone please explain why the health insurance industry has had, since 1947, the only antitrust exemption. How about having a free market? Neither party or President Obama will touch this issue, writes Tom there. Let's go to Susie in Des Moines. She's been waiting, wants to talk about health care, I believe. Susie, good afternoon.
Oh, hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question or concern about health care is, of course, the cost of medications. But I keep hearing all this wanting to change. I think the majority do want and know we need a change when it comes to the cost. But what I haven't been able to figure out is how are we going to do it? I mean, you know, I've tried to read or skim through those 2,000 pages of the healthcare reform.
Good for you.
It's extremely difficult. But, you know, I have a child with a pre-existing condition, and her medications alone amount to almost $60,000 a year, and that's only prescriptions. Doesn't even include the doctor visits. So if anybody has any kind of advice as to how we're going to go about doing this if Obama's health care reform continues and stays as in course, I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Okay, Susie in Des Moines, thank you for that. Thoughts from you, Arnie Arneson, on this?
Well,
how do we pay for it's nice to not exclude people with pre-existing conditions. How do we pay for it, especially when it's very expensive, as just described?
Well, it is very expensive. And so the question is, you're not going to make your savings on her child. Can we start with that? Those are the individuals where you're not going to make savings. But you are going to make savings if you can treat people in a timely fashion. And I know, Bruce, we've talked about this before. If you wait till you get to the emergency room to be treated for a condition that if you had treated it a month before would have cost the system $1,000, instead you wait, 4 weeks later, and now it's costing $50,000, you're thinking, what was the point? What did I save? And we have to look at the gestalt. That's the problem with healthcare. Healthcare in the United States is like a balloon. You punch in one side, it pops out the other. When you have so many uninsured and underinsured people, when too many people are going to specialists but not to primary care docs, when we tend to look at the most expensive drug instead of the generic that might actually do the same thing at half the cost, and we're looking at how much money we're spending in marketing drugs, why you should ever market a drug, I'll never know. That's part of our problem, is that we look at only the pieces of the pie, and no one has the guts to look at the whole system and understand it needs systemic change. Because even Obama's problem is, what did he do? He embraced private insurance that has a profit motive. Well, the profit motive doesn't make you healthy, except if you're a stockholder.
Richard is joining us from Jessup. Hi, Richard. You wanted to chime in on the health care debate. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Same scenario as the last caller. I had sat down with my employer over Christmas, and they showed not the whole company that per person that between our contribution and what they contributed was $21,000 a year towards our health insurance. And as a employee, I grossed probably in the low 40s, $42,000 to $43,000 for that year. So I just think that proportion is just way out of whack. I mean, doesn't anybody look at this other than me about, why am I paying so much? I get $100 a week taken out of my paycheck. That's $5,000 a year. And then my company's paying, that much more.
So what is your take on the health insurance reform enacted last year?
Well, I'm definitely for it. I think that it needs to be. I think we need to get more people in the pool. Get these people into the hospital. Get them into the doctors before it becomes a crisis. Keep them out of the emergency room,
okay,
where negotiate some prices that we can live with on our drugs and things like that.
Thank you for sharing your story, Richard from Jessup. I wanted to touch on a couple of other things before the hour ends. The lame duck session, which ended in December, was extremely productive. The extension of tax cuts, the ratification of the New START treaty with Russia, repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I want to ask, what do you make of the cries of some Republican lawmakers, Steve King of Iowa among them, that this is somehow not right? Here is Steve King expressing his displeasure about how the lame duck session was productive.
It's unprecedented to see that people that have been told by the American voters that they've had enough of the 111th Congress, they'd like to shut it down November 2nd. And still, Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi march on, throwing another pie in the face of the American people, driving an agenda that's not an agenda that's supported by the American people, and doing so as a last exit sign.
So a pie in the face of the American people, according to Steve King. A justified complaint, Bruce Nesmith?
Let them eat pie. First of all, it's not unprecedented that until 1933 or 4 or 5, whenever the 20th Amendment was passed, we regularly started the congressional session in December and ended it in March, which meant for every half of Congress's meetings through a two-year session was after the election. So that
lame duck session was even longer.
Yeah, it was that entire session for the year was a lame duck session. So that's certainly not unprecedented.
Well, secondly, can I just say something really quick?
Let Bruce finish up here. He had a second point.
I just want to point out that Representative King's positions, notwithstanding, that none of those things could have passed in the lame duck session without significant Republican cooperation and support.
Okay, sorry, Arnie. Go ahead, please.
No. I just want to remind them. Didn't they impeach Clinton during a lame duck session? I think they did. I just want to remember. We do a lot of productive things.
Right, they did, yes.
Including impeaching Clinton. So, it's kind of ironic that that even comes up as a comment. But I also wanted to remind people that I think most people were not offended by the extension of unemployment benefits. I actually think that they thought that was a good idea. I mean, there are a number of things that did happen, including, the payroll tax reduction. And if you look at comparisons, I'm going to recommend something, Ben. You have to have people go to Moody's analysis. Mark Zandi at Moody's did an analysis of the compromises that came out during the lame duck session, and you'd be shocked at what kind of positive economic activity was generated just during that, 2-week period. Mm. It really had a significant positive impact on all 50 states. You can complain now, but the result is, I think, significant for the country, at least for the next year.
Within the last few hours, we heard that Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, one of the most visible, forceful advocates for President Obama, is quitting his job to become a outside political advisor for the president. Latest part of President Obama shaking up his senior leadership team as he heads into these second 2 years of his 4-year term. I want to ask Bruce Nesmith, why do presidents typically do this after a couple of years? Is it to adjust to the new realities, exhaustion? What is it?
It's probably a combination of that. I think the jobs in Washington are very demanding, and frequently 2 years is about all the leave or whatever that people can take. There may be a perception that with changing circumstances, Republican majority in the House, election coming up next year, that Obama needs to shift the focus of – or at least that shift tactics. So you need to look at specific decisions. Whose decision was it? Was it Gibbs? Was it Obama's? Mm-hmm. Things like that with the different – personnel changes.
It's being reported that Gibbs is expected to work on President Obama's reelection campaign as well. Your read on this, Arnie?
Well, sometimes what we have is what I call the fig leaf of change. And let me give you an example of that. They're talking about one of the Daley brothers replacing Rahm Emanuel as the chief of staff. Well, that's a different name, and they're both got to do with Chicago, and it turns out that the Daley brother they're talking about was actually the mentor for Rahm Emanuel. So while the name may be different, the location is still the same, and who knows what the result will be, it is not uncommon. You really do want to rearrange the deck chairs. The problem is, are we rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic or on a ship of state that will stay afloat? And that's going to be interesting to watch for the next 2 years.
And on this, the first day of the 112th Congress, the new Congress, I want to ask your opinions on the differences that we're likely to see in the style of leadership as we change from Nancy Pelosi to John Boehner as leader in the House. Bruce.
Well, I think the biggest difference will be that Pelosi was Speaker when her party had the presidency and Boehner will not be. And I think that puts a person in a much different – puts much more focus on the Speaker as the leader. And I think also that Boehner – there were divisions in the Democratic caucus as well, but Boehner is facing some divisions in the Republican caucus that haven't been worked out yet in the way that they had been in the Democratic side.
Arnie.
And last but not least, it's easier to throw bombs than it is to govern. And now Boehner will be part of governing. And that's going to be his challenge. But I want to remind you, I'll leave you with a quote from Alan Wolfe. And he says, conservatives cannot govern well for the same reason that vegetarians cannot prepare a world-class beef bourguignon. If you believe that what you are called upon to do is wrong, you are not likely to do it very well. So on that note, it's going to be interesting to see how Boehner governs, because that is something he has not had to do for 2 years.
Whatever success is the 112th, this new Congress has, historically when we look at this, do successes normally get attached to the president in power or to the Congress, Bruce?
A little bit to both, but more to the president, which raises the issue of whether Boehner would really be better off throwing bombs, even as Speaker of the House.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Arnie, we have got about a minute left. Anything left in your bag? for this week?
I think we're all going to be living in interesting times, and I think what's going to be the problem for the GOP is that they embrace the Tea Party, which really doesn't like them either. So it's going to be fascinating to watch the dance to find out whether they can actually dance together to find some positive results.
Right, and many in the Tea Party did not like, Steve King did not like, that lame duck session and the cooperation shown between many of the legislators, right?
Well, and what we're seeing right now in New Hampshire, just for the folks to know, since we both play presidential primary politics, Governor Sununu was the former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party. He's stepping down, and there is now a war as who is going to replace him. Sununu has chosen a much more moderate, you know, respectable, historical Republican, and the Speaker of the House, who comes from more of the Tea Party movement, is supporting a Tea Party candidate for governor. It is getting vicious. The question is, who survives?
But these are the final words of the show from Glenda in Cedar Falls. She writes, the only way to get anything done will be to implement term limits, and then they might think about what's good in the country rather than getting themselves reelected. Bruce is shaking his head no on that. We have to go very quickly, Bruce.
You're looking at where you're going to work after your term ends.
Okay. Just creates another problem is what I'm hearing from Bruce. Thank you very much. Arnie Arneson joining us from New Hampshire. Thank you again, Arnie.
It was a pleasure.
And Bruce Nesmith of Coe College. Thank you for coming into our studio. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for all the calls and emails during this political Wednesday on The Exchange. Join us again tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer.